So this morning, what I'll present to you is what I call, in my notes at least, resources for family living. Now this involves, parents, children, husbands, wives, in-laws, grandparents, the whole works. And I think that the basic structure really needs some reinforcing. Now, a great many marriages and homes are breaking up, families are breaking up each year. We don't need much in statistics. I know the current average is about one divorce for every four marriages. And in certain sections of the country, it's just about leveled off, one to one. In parts of Los Angeles in the Southwest, it's the other way around. There are more family breakups, more legal separations than there are legal consummations of the marriage. And yet, even though people, their marriages fail, they still seek other marriages. People, we're very prone to marriage in this culture of ours. Now, the latest phenomenon, of course, that has come is a marriage without, marriage without a legal status. We don't intend to get married. We're just going to live together because we care about one another and we raise our children and so forth. And the legal ramifications of this will go on and on infinitely, and it's going to present some real problems because this is an attempt, you see, to deny that the society has a structure or that society has a right to structure itself. And yet there isn't a single culture anywhere in the world that hasn't put some pretty clear restrictions on one type of activity, and that is sexual activity. No matter where you go in terms of anthropological studies, you find that this is the one place, at least, where people do move in. And I'm going to move here so I can see you too. People do move in and they say the most private relationship between two persons is at the same time the most public relationship. And this is one place where we as a group intend to exercise control. Now this can be the incest taboo, which is almost universal to some tribes where you can only marry your second cousin twice removed. Steve? Go ring the bell, will you? Thank you. You can only marry your second cousin twice removed on your mother's side by your great-grandfather's line of descent or something like that. Some of these get to be so complicated, it must take genealogical tables more than any June moons to bring about a marriage because the studies are pretty bad. Now, at the same time, when we recognize some of these problems and pressures on marriage, we also see that the family as an institution is still pretty stable. There was a study made of college students recently, and they indicated something like 95% of them felt that the way to go was still to move into what might be called a traditional marriage, and to live with one person and to have children and raise the children and so forth. So some of this social disintegration which seems to be taking place is a nibbling at the edges. It may also be a precursor of real pressures, and this we don't know yet, but at this point it's not the mainstream. The mainstream is still find somebody, be married to them, and live with them, raise your family, and so forth. And I suspect because of the values which marriage offers, that it would be a long, long time before this disappears. See, marriage offers stability. In our culture, marriage offers status. Marriage offers legitimate sexual activity. Marriage provides a sexual partner who is basically available at all times. Marriage gives a financial base upon which to build a structure. Marriage gives then an individual a discernible place in society. He knows where he is, others know where he is, and this is really a pretty good relationship. A marriage also offers a conversational companion. Remember reading a little article once about the gay bachelor, and he says, don't be silly. You know, the picture, the stereotype of the gay bachelor is one who goes from party to party to party. He said, what really happens is that you go home every night alone, and you flick on the light in your apartment, and unless you've got the hi-fi connected with the light switch, you know, there's just no noise, no activity, because there's nobody there to greet you. And he says, it's really pretty bad. I recall the man who described the situation where he and his wife had been having some real problems, and he decided that they decided they would have a divorce, get a divorce. So he headed off for Reno, and his way, which was from the state of Washington, took him through Yellowstone Park, and he decided at least to drive that way and see something. And as he drove along, he saw a couple of bears acting as bears do, scratching themselves or something on a tree. And he said, you know, hey, look, Gladys. And then he realized that Gladys wasn't there, and he wasn't going to have her there anymore. And this set off a real train of thinking as he began to consider the companionship aspects of this whole business of being married to someone. And the net result seemed to have turned out halfway. He turned back, and they began to rethink together what this business of being married meant. Marriage is necessary, at least the sexual aspects are necessary for the propagation of the race. A family is necessary to take care of the newborn. If the children are to learn something and to be more than little savages, there has to be some kind of a socializing force. And the family has been identified rather specifically and pointedly as the force. There's a transmission of values, and you teach people how to survive. You know, man of all creatures has one of the longest periods of total dependency. And youngsters would die if there weren't parents to take care of them. Now, this isn't always true in other aspects of nature, but it certainly is here. And so parental character and parental methods all enter into this whole picture. George Santayana, the philosopher, speaks of the value of being half, of being born half-formed. He said a child is born and he's got a heritage, and he has his genetic makeup and so forth, but really, more than any other creature, he is formed by his environment and by his associates. And so he comes and he's only half formed. And now all of these vectors will play in upon him, and they will make of him the kind of creature he has to be to survive in the kind of world in which he has been born, and to survive in the kind of family into which he's been born. Now, when you talk about families, let me ask you, just to get in on this a little bit, what family ritual was most predominant in your home? Birthday? Being put to bed every night? You say that with a smile on your face. I suspect it was mostly a pleasant experience. Plus it was earlier than everybody else on the block. What else do you recall? How about your personal rituals in a marital situation? Do you have any rituals there that you use, that you're aware of? See, rituals are part of this socializing business. It's part of where we came from. It's the way we transmit to our children. I remember I was sort of disappointed when I found that my son, who is married, and his wife are now observing the opening of Christmas presents in the morning instead of the obvious time, which is Christmas Eve. And why is it obvious? Because that's the way we did it in our family, in my family. And that's the way he was taught, and you know, he's broken away from it teachings that his father and mother gave him. That woman has lured him out of our clutches, you see. And has given him, imposed a new set of ritual values on him. Well, we have them. They're bedtime, and it's bath time, and it's party time, and cleaning time, and Sunday morning, and holidays, and holy days. And there are a great many rituals which develop in the intimacy of marriage. Rituals provide security. They tell you, I know what to do. You know, what would kids do on Christmas if they hadn't been raised in homes where you observe Christmas? You know, think about it. Or what would you do if you were to suppose you were a guest in a Jewish home during Hanukkah? You would be an observer in general if your background is Christian, because you would not know what to do. Yet last night we saw the Seder, and you know, we were spectators in measure, though Herb tried very much to bring us into the action, but we were spectators. Rituals tell us, I know what to do, and furthermore, I know what will happen. See, so we've got something down the road, and we can anticipate. So we just don't discount these. Elton Trueblood, the Quaker philosopher, theologian, has written quite a bit on rituals. In fact, I've been amazed at how much you can find on rituals and how important they are in the socializing process and in strengthening a family together. Rituals provide continuity. You know, life continues. I remember the first Christmas after my father died. He died in November, a couple of days before Thanksgiving. A month later, you know, how could a family gather for a celebration? Well, we did, because it was a religious celebration. There were some tears, yes, but there were also things like a tree, and some gifts, and some memories, and so forth. And the reading of the Christmas gospel, these were the rituals that allow life to continue. Just last night, I was reading about a Jewish ritual where the family stays together with a bereaved person for 8 days after death has taken place. And the reason they do this is to help a person back into the mainstream of life. And the first day, a woman may be crying at the loss of her husband, and that afternoon she may be exchanging gossip with someone who has dropped in, and then in this process of naturalizing and neutralizing some of the shocks that come, the family is held together. Rituals emphasize, you see, we belong. This is our way of doing things. These are ours. These are our secrets. It really tickled me the other day to talk to someone who said, well, you know, in our family we practiced FHB. And I laughed. I was simply delighted, because that means family hold back. And that's when there's not quite enough food and you have guests that have arrived unexpectedly. So the word gets passed in the kitchen, FHB. And that means that you take a small helping, or you wait until everybody's been served and you decline the second helping because you really didn't want those luscious pork chops anyway. But you learn something, you see, and it's part of the family. Now, another real resource in a family is individual honesty. I think we're learning this today more than ever before, how absolutely necessary it is for people to be honest in a family. We have been raised in that culture, many of us, where this has not been practiced, where nothing came out in the open, or even arguments were always back bedroom, closed door affairs between husband and wife. And this was not particularly good. You know, when people, when kids, for instance, don't see their parents having an argument, and then resolving it, having an argument within the confines of marriage, and then bringing it to a resolution. Again, how do they learn to be a married couple? What's going to happen the first time they have an argument? You see, what we do, the rituals with which we even solve our arguments, are very, very important in a marriage relationship. In some of the island cultures, if a man and his wife are on the outs and he leaves fishing for the day, he comes back, if he finds the water bucket on the porch is upside down, he knows she hasn't cooled off yet and he better go fishing for the evening period too. But if the water bucket is hung up in its proper place, she has told him very ritualistically and yet very clearly, okay, come home, you know, things are okay and we can talk about it, or I've cooled off, or whatever it may be. And I'm sure that there were the same kind of rituals for when a man is displeased with his wife and the fullness of the thing lies there. John McMurray of Scotland wrote a book about reason and emotion, and in this book he talks about chastity. In fact, he writes a whole chapter on the case for chastity. But he's not talking about sexual chastity. He's talking about honesty in communication. He's talking about men and women, you know, looking at one another and really saying what's going on. There's a great deal of emphasis today in almost every form of counseling on this matter of listening for what is being said, not with words, but what is being said emotionally. The average woman who has lived in marriage for a while will say to this thick-headed character, look, when I say go away, I don't mean go away. What I really mean is come close, because I'm lonesome, we're at odds with one another, and we've got to work this out. So McMurray says, what you need in marriage is honesty of communication. And you say what's really there, and you don't beat around the bush. Now, this does not mean to club people, either physically or with words, but to talk about your feelings. What you have said has hurt me, or what you have said makes me feel insecure, or it makes me feel like a child, or it makes me feel angry, or it leaves me confused. Well, this thing can be dealt with, you see. There is a type of communication which is called active listening. And active listening is just when you try very, very hard to listen to what is being communicated, not in words, but what is being communicated in emotion. And once you learn this, then all kinds of things begin to open up in terms of human relationships. Now this can be teacher and pupil. This can be girlfriend and boyfriend. This can be husband and wife. It can be parents and children. The one place where I particularly studied this was in a parent's effectiveness class. How to be an effective parent. And you are an effective parent by listening to what the child has to say. Not his words, but the emotion he's expressing. And then you reflect this back. You try to say in other words, or you try to say back to him what he has said to you, or what he's been communicating to you about his feelings. A child comes in and he says, I'm never going back to school again. Well, what do you do? Oh, yes, you are. Or, where did you get such nonsense? okay, you don't have to, which is an unusual parental reaction. There being state laws and all that. But what's really happening, you know? Well, you better find out. You sound very angry to me. And then the child can come back. You know, you've recognized his feelings. I am angry. The teacher is unfair. Well, you're moving along a little bit, you see. But you don't then say, no, she isn't. or, you know, things aren't always always perfect in school and so forth. You don't cut off this flow of communication. Rather, at this point, you try to say, again, you reflect the feelings. You sound really upset with your teacher. Or something is bothering you inside about how things are at school. And by this kind of a process, you let things be communicated. It's called active listening. The problem that most of us have with our relationships with other people is that we come up with a solution almost immediately, particularly if we are in some kind of an authority relationship with the other. If we are parents, we're teachers. Well, I know what to do, or I'll call the teacher. Or you mean he really hit you? Let's get at it, or we'll buy a new one. You know, we have quick answers, quick solutions. And what happens is that the emotions never get poured out. By the time the emotions are out, oftentimes you find that the problem has been taken care of. Or the child then is strong enough, the wife and the husband then, has been listened to enough so that he or she can come up with his or her own solutions to the problem. Of course.
It must be really hard to act like that, especially when a child is having not good feelings about himself, like in growing up, discovering things that he or she doesn't like about himself and not, you know, feeling not okay.
Mm-hmm.
I know that my parents, and I would guess it would be a tendency of most parents to go, you know, very soon after a child expresses feelings like that. Well, everyone has feelings like that, or you really are good. Look, this is, you know, this is how I see you, or you are good, and look at all the good things that have happened, and look at all the good things you've been able to bring about, and your friends, and on them. And that, it seems like that, though it is sort of constructive,
isn't
it really, because those are the feelings that, like, I'm having, and they're real, and somehow I have to learn to deal with those. What sort of reaction can a parent have?
Well, what it is, you see, is the quick reassurance. And we're culturally prone to do this. We want to reassure people. We don't want people to be unhappy because that makes us unhappy. So we don't recognize their feelings. We'd rather not. It's upsetting to know that some of the children are unhappy, or my boyfriend is feeling discouraged. So you try and build him up and make him feel good, you know. And in the process, his real feelings don't get recognized.
I think another thing, what you say is right, but in the fact of being a parent trying to communicate with the child, the older they get, seems to me their anger that you see is entirely different from what it really is. At least from my standpoint, it's hard for me figure out what the real problem is, because what they're telling me, that isn't necessarily the thing they're truly, deeply angry about, and sometimes they don't know either.
But do you have to find out what the problem
is? No, it's very hard to accept the fact that you can't solve all their problems.
Mm-hmm.
You just let them pour it out, and I don't always do this, I try. And most of the time I'm a failure, I must say, but I do think there are a few times I'm like, maybe I did the right thing. Because sooner or later, in your vomiting up all this stuff, you see them cool down, you've done nothing. Except listening.
Mm-hmm.
But I can understand what you're saying, it's so much easier than everything you've done right, you know. And it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels really awful. And this is my personal stress right now, and I think it's important for parents to know, because it's really an easy time right now. It's really awful when a parent contradicts your feelings, like, especially, you know, about yourself, because that just sets up more conflict in yourself, you know, like, what are they seeing that I don't see? And, oh, no.
Yes.
Where are these feelings of insecurity and inadequacy and so forth, where are they coming? Are environmentally or from inside, or reaction toward parents or just...
Well, there's an interesting book written called I'm Okay, You're Okay. You've probably seen it. Well, you may recall when he talks about the child, he says for the first 5 years of life, we pick up impressions about ourselves. And since we're the low man on the totem pole, the littlest guy, you know, the one who's always in trouble, the one who has to have 10,000 no-nos because there are electric buzz saws and everything else all over that can hurt you, the child, he says it's almost impossible for a child not to grow up with some real negative feelings about himself. So we really should start with the fact that it's quite natural for us to feel that we are not so good. I'm not okay. And that's in it, and that basically then is in every one of us. So let's accept that fact as long as we do, that we have two legs and no wings, and live in that kind of a psychological environment. I recall reading the example of the couple who had been traveling across the country with two children. One was about two, and he sat in the front seat. The other was about five, and he was delegated to the back seat. And they finally arrived almost at their destination, which was crossing one of the bridges into New York. And the mother leaned back, and she said to the boy in the back seat, "You have been such a good boy." And the place just disintegrated. The kid went through the roof. He threw all the toys that had been around in the back seat up. He screamed and he hollered and so forth. And she hadn't the slightest idea what had happened until, on examination, what had happened is, here's this little kid in the back seat. He has been relegated to the back seat. He hates his little brother, who gets to sit in the front seat and gets all the good little things. He has been thinking of how he would like to, you know, have him just pushed under a truck or into the river or, you know, fall into the steering wheel and have his neck twisted or something like that. And these are the feelings that he's having. His mother turns around and says, "What a good boy you are." And he can't stand it because he knows he's not a good boy. That moment, he's a real hateful kid. Now, what she could have said, you see, was, "I appreciate so much your sitting in the back seat for this long trip without complaining." Now, you see, that would have recognized the situation. She wouldn't have tried to interpret his feelings for him because she missed. Obviously, at the moment, he was committing homicide and mayhem and thoroughly enjoying it. He was caught, so he blew up. Now, the standard rule of thumb here is that you keep feeding back the feelings, and you do this until the individual begins to come up with the solutions himself. And then you know that you have been feeding enough back. And until that time, you know, the temptation is to seize that golden opportunity to get in with the reassurance or the ego-bolstering statement or whatever may be necessary, and not let the person really empty himself. Now, you use the term, you know, vomiting out. Which suggests that there's almost an unlimited supply of angers and tensions and misunderstandings that are there, and that's oftentimes true too. Sometimes when you face the problems of racial minorities who have really been put down and put down and put down, there is no limit to the kind of feelings that come out. But still, it's necessary to listen and listen. And what happens is that there is some relieving of the tension because you understood. I recall on one occasion some disagreement had arisen in our family. It was more than just a disagreement. I think it had something to do with finances, which is problem number one in most marriages. And I was feeling very rejected. And my wife said something like this: I know how you must be feeling, and I wish we could handle this some other way. I'm not sure what it was. But it was a tremendously understanding statement. And I could feel my tension and my anger and my resentment and my feeling rejection just literally run off me, just like I'd taken a cape, you know, and untied it, let the thing slide over my shoulders and down to the floor, and it was gone. It was a tremendous experience. I'd never forgotten it. Because I then saw that I had wrapped myself in a mantle of resentment, and it could be let go, and she had the key. And she untied it, you see, by her understanding of my feeling at the moment. And then down it went, and we were able to move on to something else. One man who now is heading up a pretty large organization in this parent effectiveness training says that sometimes a question came up about the artificiality of this business. You know, okay, now you're active listening again. But he says, in our marriage, he said, sometimes I will come home from my work and I will be so frustrated that I will say, Diane, just active listen for a few minutes, will you? You know, don't give me all the garbage about what the kids did today and so forth. Just active listen to me. And so she does. She reflects back her feelings and so forth, and this is a catharsis. And he then is then able to find himself balanced and back into the family situation again. And then he can go on and find out all the things that the kids did during the day and maybe active listen to some of her frustration. Well, what we see here is that we have a complexity of things going on. It's not something you can't pull out a little formula and apply it unless you've been able to work this out some way, as this instructor had. But basically, it seems to me that it's something that we become consciously aware of and then try. Because the best evidence that comes in is that this is probably one of the better ways of relating to other people. When you listen, but you listen for the feeling. Carl Jung had an experience once when he came to New York. He was met by the bellboy at the hotel, and the bellboy took him up to his room, and knowing him, you know, distinguished visitor and all that, and a visiting psychiatrist, he started telling him about his problems with his family. You know, all the way up the elevator, down the hall, into the room, all the little activities that take place, the windows, the air, the towels, the lights, and so forth. And then he was through, and so he bid him goodbye. 8 years later, Jung came back to the same hotel, and the bellboy was still there. And he came up to him and he said, I want to thank you so much for all the help you gave me the last time you were here. And Jung said, you know, my recollection is I didn't say a single word to him, but I listened to him. And the power of listening emotionally is just fantastic. We all need so badly to be understood, and we all need so badly to have our childish, you know, our childish perceptions of ourselves somehow placed in balance so that we can function in an extremely complex society. Many of the aggressions which could be taken out in times past on a tree stump because you were clearing the back 40, you know, this was really good. One of the finest ways to, when one feels really upset and angry, I suppose this is a woman who has one available all the time, if she's in the home, is to go in and pound the bed. Really pound the bed. Counselors, and, well, I was at a session recently in which there's a real nifty little gadget, but this long, it's made out of foam rubber and so forth, and when you hit somebody with it, it makes the most lovely sound, you know, whack, and you'd swear you were crushing every bone in the person's body, but it doesn't hurt. And this therapist takes these things and hands them to a man or a wife and says, okay, you know, hit him. Get some of it out. Beat him over the back. And some of this aggression comes out, or it will be, you know, pound the table with it. And it's the most rewarding sound. It sounds very, very destructive, but it gets the feelings out. This business of pounding beds is important because you get the feelings out. They're there. Usually when, and I don't understand all the dynamics of it myself, but I do know that when feelings get expressed, there's a working through process by which a balance and adjustment return to the situation. Too often we have these strong negative feelings inside of anger, maybe towards ourselves, it may be towards others, and they don't get out. And anger is almost a measurable quantity, or it can be measured almost like you're dealing with quantity. I have, you know, 7 units of anger. You're lucky, I have 700. And they're all right here. And sometimes they go up right here, and people have heart attacks, simply because they've got all the anger inside, and it's got to go someplace. You have these calm, quiet, cool people who never show emotion, and you say, what in the world happens to the anger? Someone else will blow up and scream and yell, and it's over, and this person takes this whole business, this insult, this put down, this disappointment, as if it really didn't make any difference anyway, and yet humanly speaking you realize it must have. Well, where does it go? Maybe it goes into an ulcer, maybe it goes into a heart attack. Maybe it goes into throat constriction, maybe it goes into muscular problems, but it's got to go somewhere. And this is the whole business, you see, of getting it out and expressing. Much of the therapy of today is simply letting people get out the things that are inside, and some of the transformations that occur are simply fantastic. People's faces change, people's body, they walk differently. After a half an hour, an hour's session of a good, you know, people always write about their successes, but there's enough of this that is written to indicate how real this is. So I saw these beautiful bats with which you beat people, or the bed, or lying on the bed and kicking. Or going out and chopping down a tree, or digging the garden, or cleaning the house. These are ways in which we reduce aggression. Today we live in a complex society where if you push something, you're going to break it. If you hit something or hit someone, you're going to be in court. And there's no chance, you see, for just the normal things to take place. That we're very therapeutic. Now, you have to make a distinction, of course, between feeling something and acting it out. I have a good friend, a psychologist in New York, Dr. John Kildow, and he said one day my 4-and-a-half-year-old was down in the shop, down in my basement shop with me, and he wanted to use a saw, and I wouldn't let him. And he insisted that he wanted to use a saw, and I still wouldn't let him, because 4-and-a-half-year-olds just don't use saws. At least not where I am involved. And the little kid yelled at him and he said, I hate you and I'm going to cut off your head. Well, John said, you know, I could have gotten real excited about this. What an awful way to talk to your father. But he said, I remarked to him, you really are angry about the saw, aren't you? And he said, yes, I am. And then he said, we were able to talk about how he felt about this and not get too concerned about the saw itself. Now, he said, if on the other hand he had picked up that saw and had come for my neck, then I would have had, I would have gone into a different reaction pattern, largely defensive. And he said, we can talk, we can verbalize. And this comes back now to this honesty of communication. We must say things, but we do have no right whatsoever to act them out. The person who strikes another person he has left all communication behind and has just reverted to a different level of social and non-social action. John McMurray says relationships should be like a picture. Now, look at the picture over there, the snow. There's the snow, and around it there's a white border, and that's all. Now, if that picture were framed in a gilt frame with a lot of gewgaws around it and so forth, and a light that came over and shone on it and so forth, by the time all of this has transpired, all these trappings are there, you wouldn't see the picture anymore, really. So he says that there must be, he speaks of chastity, if this building is chaste. No one has boxed in these beams. You know, we know what holds the roof up. If we see termite, sawdust coming out of that beam, we better do something about it, because that's the thing that holds up the roof. This is fairly clear, you know. They put black paint on it, nothing else. This is solid. No attempt to conceal the basic ingredients. That's the way it ought to be in relationships. We should be able to speak to people honestly, communicate, and find out what's going on inside them. I remember the phrase, the furies of domestic life. It's a beautiful one. Most people in marriage, do not take to wielding baseball bats and shooting off guns. But there are all kinds of little things that cause fury, real deep anger, resentment. The violations of privacy, there's a strong correlation between the amount of space that people have to live in, living space, and marital happiness or family happiness. And this, I think, just becomes obvious when you examine it a little bit. Violations of privacy, the demands which people make upon one another, the inability to get away and be by yourself, the inability in a family situation to simply leave and go for a while, to escape from it, the frustrations of desires, the clash of wills, the disappointments in one another, the counter purposes which develop. When I'm speaking with young couples, sometimes I talk about, where do you squeeze the toothpaste tube? In the middle, are you a squeezer or are you a roller? In our affluent society, of course, today we solve that by getting two tubes. But this sort of wasn't always the case. Now, those are the little things that come, but they're emblematic of the many deeper ones that exist. And you see, marital adjustment really doesn't come at the point of the toothpaste tube. Marital adjustment, or the need for it, comes when you have two people who really think differently, deeply, about something that is meaningful to them. I had a man and his wife counseling with me at one time. He was from Germany. And he had a very authoritarian concept of what marriage was to be like. This was what he had observed in his own family. And what he saw then, or what he saw was himself as making the basic decision. And I said, well, now suppose you feel you're right, but suppose your wife feels that she is right. And the only solution he had was, well, if I feel I'm right, I can't possibly go against what I feel to be right. Now, you know, how do you resolve a tension like this? What is compromise? What are the realities of not getting your way in a marital situation, of even going counter to what you feel to be right? They were in for some real problems. In fact, they were already in the midst of the problems. That's partly why they came to see me. There is really no better place, I suppose, than a home in which to work out difficulties. Because where do we feel the safest? There would be a lot less anger and tension displayed in a home if there were not some real securities built into the home. You know, you don't tell off your boss because he can fire you. But you may tell off your spouse because the chances are, your experience indicates, that he or she will not fire you, will not leave you. So you feel safe then to battle for your human rights within the confines of the family. Here you see, you feel safe enough to really be yourself. You don't have to pretend, you don't have to wear a mask, but you can simply be really, truly yourself. Well, we can pick up some other things here, but maybe I think I'm just going to make a brief reference to them, and then we'll see whether we want to go any further. In the family situation, discipline can be a real resource. Discipline does not mean to punish. It means to teach. And there's an extremely important difference. Discipline involves providing alternate choices so that the business of making decisions becomes natural for a child. Our children, all of us have to grow up with some sense of competency in our own judgments. You don't tell a child, you don't give him the option of going to school or not, but you may give him the option of whether he's going to wear his blue coat or his green coat today, or whether or not he wants to participate in try out for the play. I mean, these are his decisions. A lot of problems can be resolved if you decide whose problem it is in the first place. Now, is it his problem or your problem? When is a problem your problem? Let me give you some examples and ask questions. How about school grades in a family situation? Whose problem is this? I have a daughter who isn't particularly interested in the scientific area, which is putting it mildly. Is it my problem or her problem? Do I insist that she take chemistry and physics or not?
You're the one that seems concerned, so I would suspect it's your problem.
That part of it is, because you can't detach yourself.
Because
you're
not
even.
I don't
see how you can make, well, you can insist to that child take it, but you still can't solve that problem because you can't get through it.
It's your problem when you have to get involved. It's your problem if you have to go to school. No, a kid can't say, well, it's my business. No, it isn't. I've got a note from your principal. I've got to take time off from work. Suddenly it has become my problem. At the moment when, if you want to take the detention and sit after school and get a ride from home, it's fine. But if I've got to go over and get you because the bus has left, then don't you tell me it's not my problem. Suddenly I am involved. And we can get in on these things, and we can legitimately put handles on them because we are involved. I think it would help us a great deal, though, if we made the distinction between and left more problems with the child where the problems really are. Why should they not learn to deal with the consequences, or how do they learn to deal with the consequences of their actions? If we don't let them sit and actually suffer through some of it. My brother came from Germany the other day, and he brought his 7-year-old or 8-year-old son with him, and they went to Disneyland. We got a lot in, actually. We went to a ball game, Major League ball game, and then we went to Disneyland. But at the ball game, the boy wanted to buy a pennant. And my brother's perception of this is it's one more thing that he will take home, one more thing that he will take home, and it will hang or will go in a drawer or something, and there it will sit. So that, you know, I know how things operate. So he let him work it out. And this kid, you know, he took his billfold, he had money. He'd been saving some money for this trip to California, so he had money, and he took his billfold out, and he looked at it, and he counted it, and then he looked at the pennants, and then he looked in here, and then he looked at the pennants, and then he put it away, and then he took it out again, and finally, after about 10 minutes, not, you know, we were also watching the game, but after about 10 minutes, we noticed that he had purchased a small megaphone, which cost about 1/3 the price of the other. And then he remarked, look, this is no great traumatic thing. It's not going to kill him, whichever way he goes. It's not going to hurt him. But it really makes him make the decision. And he can do it if he wants to, but then there is not going to be as much for Disneyland tomorrow or something of this sort. It was his problem. And the father just refused to get in on it. By bailing him out, by loaning him a little bit, or saying, well, it's a special occasion. We're only in California once in every 3 years, you know. Now, I have agreed with Steve while we're here that he will have so much money per week. And I gave it to him all at once. Not, you know, week by week. I wasn't going to overwhelm him with 40 cents per whole month. But I gave him a sum of money. And that has to carry him through this week. And the way he's going, I figure about tomorrow noon he should be completely broke. And then he'll have to sit until Monday, and I'm going to let him sit. Mm-hmm. Because it won't hurt him. He might even eat a little more at the dining hall. And he will have learned something about handling money. You know, it's very difficult in an affluent society. Mm-hmm. Deal with these problems.
That's the problem, because our children right now are broke, and we've been hearing that they have enough money to last a month or two. So if we take this on ourselves, we have the problem, which we aren't doing either. The point is, they know we have the money. This makes it more difficult than ever. It isn't a matter of being what we were, depression babies, when our parents said, there isn't no more anymore. There was no question.
Mm-hmm.
This is I find this a problem in a lot of areas, not just money. In going and doing and many things, our children have to be told, yes, we do have money, but we don't feel that you need it anymore. I don't know what it does to them, and I'm not so certain that it matters, but it makes it a bigger problem than we had before, because they think it's endless.
And how do you cope with your own guilty feelings? You know, you do something. My wife currently is in England on, well, it's professional. She's an English teacher, and so she's on a literary tour, in a sense. But it costs, you know, quite a bit of money. Now, if I say to my daughter or my son, no, you can't have 50 cents more, somewhere along the line, you know, he's going to put this together and say, well, you do this, mother does that, and here I've run out of popcorn money, and it's only Thursday. It's difficult. I don't have the answers yet myself.
I don't have any jokes in that area.
What?
I don't have any jokes in that area on money.
How do you handle
it? It's budgeted, that's it. There is no more, whether I've got it there or not, that's it. And it's always been that way. And she knows it. And so she looks for money, she budgets it out, and she runs out, she runs out. I guess maybe because I was raised in Depression era and such, it carried over with me. I guess I didn't go quite as easy as some parents did from that era, but and maybe I struggled enough with it.